Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome. Today we're diving deep into a novel that really took one of the most shattering events of the last century, the 1947 partition of India, and, well, brought it down to human scale. A single devastating story. We're talking about Khushwant Singh's 1956 masterpiece, Train to Pakistan. And our mission really is to explore how this book turns this huge political catastrophe into something intensely personal. You know, a drama about love, fear, cowardice, and sacrifice right on that new border.
Oh, absolutely. It's such a crucial book if you want to understand the human impact of partition. And Khushwant Singh, well, he lived through it all. 1915 to 2014, he wasn't just a novelist. He was a journalist, a historian, and importantly, a staunch secularist. His writing is known for being just brutally honest.
Yeah, that honesty. I think that's what made Train to Pakistan so radical back in 56. A lot of writing about partition then was, you know, very political or maybe kind of romanticized the struggle. Singh just, he stripped all that away. It gave us this raw, realistic picture. The chaos, the corruption, the sheer awful violence when neighbors suddenly weren't neighbors anymore.
And to picture it, you need to imagine this place, Manomadra. It's fictional, yes, but vivid. A small village, and critically, it's right on the new border between India and Pakistan. But before partition hits, it's this little pocket of harmony. Sikhs and Muslims, they've lived side by side for generations, pretty much unaware of the big political storms brewing elsewhere.
And their lives weren't run by news from Delhi or Lahore, were they? It was something much more immediate.
Exactly. It was the trains. The railway station at Manomadra, the trains passing through, that was the heartbeat of the village. It meant order, connection, the daily rhythm. But as we see, that symbol of order gets twisted into something horrific.
So that sets up the core tension Singh explores, and this is where it gets really gripping. Can ordinary human decency, you know, neighborliness, love, can any of that survive when these huge abstract political forces just descend, this idea of nationhood suddenly imposed, just smashing into the intimate reality of village life?
Okay, so let's unpack the people caught in this. To really get the crisis, you need to look at these three men who kind of represent the moral spectrum in Manomadra. Their choices drive everything.
Right. Let's start with Jugat Singh, or Jugat. He's presented initially as, well, he's a budmash, a local Sikh criminal, a dacoit, an outcast by the village's own rules. But his love for Nuran, as a Muslim woman, that crosses all the lines, religious, social. And as these new artificial divisions are forced on people, his very personal, simple love ends up being maybe the most morally pure thing in the story. There's this capacity for heroism hidden under that rough exterior.
And then almost as polar opposite, you have Iqbal Singh, the educated outsider. Mm-hmm. Iqbal. He's a social worker, comes in full of modern ideas, secularism, communism, progress. He's articulate, intellectual. He's supposed to be the model citizen for a new India, right?
Right.
But he's completely ineffective. Utterly impotent, really. All his theories, his sophisticated analysis about unity and justice, they just crumble. They mean nothing when faced with raw, visceral hatred and fear. He ends up sort of paralyzed by his own thinking.
Yeah.
And the irony, the dark irony, is when he gets arrested, the police aren't even sure if he's Sikh or Muslim. It shows how absurd the labels are, but also how deadly they've become.
And the third point of this triangle, Hukum Chand. The district magistrate, he's the government, the face of the state in all this. He's cynical, definitely flawed drinks, uses prostitutes, but he's not blind. He knows about the political games being played. He feels the guilt.
Yeah, he embodies the system. It's supposed to maintain order, protect people, but it's completely overwhelmed by the chaos. A chaos it, in some ways, helped unleash. He has power, but it's useless. So you've got the criminal, the intellectual, and the corrupt official. That's the framework for this society just before it falls apart.
And the trigger isn't some big battle, is it? It starts small, local.
That's right. The first crack in Manomadra's peace isn't directly partition violence. It's the murder of Ramlal, the village moneylender, by a rival gang led by Marley. But it's crucial because it immediately shows how broken the justice system is becoming under pressure.
Right, because the police don't really care who did it. They just need scapegoats, basically.
Exactly. They need quick arrests. So who do they pick? Jugga, the known criminal, and Iqbal, the weird intellectual outsider, easy targets. So the village's own sense of who's who, of justice, it gets immediately overridden by this external corrupt system.
And with justice already failing, the doors open for the real horror to come in.
Precisely. That sets the stage for the absolute turning point, the descent into what the novel calls Kalyug, the Age of Darkness, and that is the arrival of the ghost train.
Ah, yes, the moment the abstract news reports become terrifyingly real.
Oh, absolutely. A train arrives from the newly formed Pakistan, and it's silent. Eerily silent. It's not full of refugees fleeing. It's packed, shoulder to shoulder, with the bodies of slaughtered Sikhs and Hindus. The silence, the smell described, the sheer overwhelming horror of it brings the distant violence right into the heart of Manomajra. It shatters everything. That train, once the symbol of reliable routine, is now literally a vessel of death, and instantly fear replaces generations of trust.
And fear, as the book shows so starkly, is just fuel for cruelty, isn't it? Once that visceral horror lands, the social fabric just unravels incredibly fast. The authorities then decide all Muslims must be evacuated for their own safety. That includes Noran. And suddenly, these lifelong bonds are just severed.
Mm-hmm. And into that vacuum, that space left by the departing Muslims and the lingering fear, comes the final terrible plan. Radical Sikh extremists arrive. They've heard about the ghost train, and they want revenge. They manage to poison the atmosphere, whipping up the remaining villagers, people who lived peacefully with their Muslim neighbors just weeks before, into a frenzy.
And the plan they come up with is just chillingly brutal.
Horrifyingly simple. Ambush the next train going to Pakistan. The train carrying Manomajra's own evacuated Muslims. They'll stretch a thick steel rope across the railway bridge over the river, low enough to sweep the roof of the train clean. A guaranteed massacre, from Harmony to plotting mass murder in just a few weeks.
So this is the ultimate moral test. Hukum Chand, the magistrate, maybe trying to salvage something, some shred of conscience, orders Iqbal and Jugga released. He hopes one of them, maybe both, will do something. Stop it. The lives of hundreds hang on what the intellectual and the criminal will do.
And we know Iqbal's response. Tragically, he thinks, he calculates, he considers the ethics, the politics, the risks. He understands the situation perfectly, but he's paralyzed by his intellect. He can't act. The idealist frozen by theory.
But Jugga, his motivation is completely different, isn't it?
Totally different. It's immediate. It's primal. It's personal. He finds out about the ambush plan, and he knows Noran is on that train. And she's pregnant with his child. His love for her, that specific personal love, becomes this incredibly powerful force. The only force strong enough, it seems, to cut through the collective tide of hatred.
And the climax.
Yeah.
It's incredibly tense.
It's breathless. Night falls. The train is approaching. Jugga gets to the bridge. He climbs the steel structure, finds the thick rope stretched tight across the tracks. He takes out his kirpan, the Sikh ceremonial dagger, and just starts hacking at it, frantically.
Knowing he's completely exposed up there.
Completely. The conspirators waiting below, they see him, they open fire, he's hit, badly wounded, but he keeps slashing at that rope. Singh's prose here is so direct, so unadorned, just describing the physical struggle. And then literally moments before the train reaches the bridge, he cuts through. The rope falls away, the train speeds across, safely, heading towards Pakistan, and Jugger's body falls from the bridge. He saved them. He saved Noran.
It's just devastating. And it's not political heroism, is it? It's an act of love.
Yeah.
Pure, selfless, individual love against organized communal hate. Redemption, but at the ultimate cost.
Mm.
Okay, so the story reaches its climax there, but let's dig into what Singh is really saying. The themes resonate so strongly even today. That idea about the arbitrariness of division seems central.
Absolutely. Singh forces us to see how constructed religious identity can be, how easily it's manipulated for political ends. The Sikhs and Muslims in Manomajra, they shared everything, culture, language, daily life. They were a community. Until politics declared their differences suddenly mattered more than anything else, more than life itself. There's that powerful line someone says, this isn't India, this isn't Pakistan, this is Manomajra. It really drives home that local lived reality versus the abstract political lines drawn on a map.
Right, and that connects straight to Iqbal's failure, doesn't it? The failure of ideology. Is Singh saying secularism is flawed, or that detached intellectualism just isn't enough in a crisis?
I think it's more the latter. It's a critique of abstract theories, secularism, communism, whatever, when they aren't backed by action, by courage. They prove useless against raw fear and mob violence. Iqbal knows what's right, theoretically, but he can't bring himself to do anything. It's a stark warning, isn't it? Ideology without the guts to act on it is just words.
And the flip side is Jugga's redemption.
Mm.
The Budmash, the criminal, becomes the hero, but not for God or country.
No, not at all. It's purely personal. Love for Noran, for his unborn child. The book suggests heroes often get themselves killed for nothing, but Jugis' sacrifice isn't for glory. It's driven by the most fundamental human connection. It really underlines Singh's point, I think, that real courage, real nobility, often comes from unexpected places, driven by personal bonds, not grand ideas.
And the way Singh tells the story, the style itself is crucial, that recurring symbol of the train.
Oh, it's brilliant symbolism. It starts as routine, order, then it becomes the ghost train, a carrier of death. Pure horror. And finally, thanks to Jugga, it becomes this fragile vessel of escape, of hope, however temporary. The meaning shifts dramatically, reflecting the whole village's descent and the possibility of redemption.
And the language. People describe it as stark, unembellished, almost journalistic.
Yes, and that's key. It's not sentimental. Singh doesn't layer on emotional commentary. He presents the violence, the decay, the sacrifice, almost like facts. And that lack of overt manipulation makes the horror feel even more real, more impactful. It lets the inherent drama, the irony, speak for itself. The criminal is the savior, the intellectual fails, the authorities are corrupt. It hits harder because it's not telling you how to feel.
So reading it or listening to this story, it really does force you to think about your own capacity for good or ill, doesn't it? And how fragile our civilized societies might actually be. It reveals both the absolute worst that's organized communal violence and the absolute best that's selfless individual love, sometimes in the very same people, under pressure.
I think that's exactly right. And maybe the lasting message of Train to Pakistan is that warning. Collective morality can collapse easily. So individual conscience, individual courage becomes vital. And perhaps the greatest courage isn't found in big ideologies, but in those simple, seemingly small acts of love and sacrifice.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.